This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, April 18th, 2007. From Richmond, Virginia, I'm Catherine Kump, sitting in for Auda Bogado. Coming up in today's newscast, the U.S. Supreme Court rules that second trimester abortions are illegal. In Indonesia, thousands demand better working conditions at one of the world's largest copper mines. And the U.S. and Australia strike a deal to swap asylum seekers.
In a quid pro quo relationship to send people more than halfway across the world in order to get both governments out of what is essentially a difficult situation.
These stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. A series of car bomb explosions in Shiite neighborhoods in Baghdad killed at least 170 people today and wounded nearly 200. Hiba Dawood reports.
The first explosion took place in a central Baghdad community dominated by Shiite Kurds. The second blast occurred in Sadr city, also home of the Mehdi army, a militia loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada Sadr. The Mehdi army used to play a very important role in neighborhood security. Militia members would patrol at night, provide assistance to the local residents, and even direct the traffic during the day. But a crackdown on the Mehdi army resulted in the arrest of many of its members and has caused the security situation in Sadr city to disintegrate. Abu Huda is a resident of Sadr city who witnessed today's explosion.
The Mehdi army used to cooperate with the Iraq forces in securing the city. There wasn't a lot of traffic in the streets, and they prevented the suicide bombers from coming in, because the Mehdi army knows most of the people who come in. Now the police and army are focusing on the big trucks only, and when the driver gives them money, they take it and let the truck that might be full of explosives go.
The third bomb went off in Karada, another Shiite-majority neighborhood that faces at least a couple explosions every month. A fourth explosion on a minibus killed another two people. In all, more than 150 people died in what has become one of the bloodiest days in Baghdad since the start of the security operation in February. I'm Hiba Dawood for FSRN.
Jordan and Syria have asked the international community for donations to help cope with the influx of refugees from Iraq. Ula Farawati has more.
Syria hosts an estimated 1.2 million Iraqis, while Jordan says around 750,000 refugees currently reside here. Syrian Vice Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad said his country needs $256 million to continue providing Iraqi refugees with aid, healthcare, and education over the next 2 years. Jordan's Deputy Interior Minister Mkhaymer Abu Jamous estimates Iraqi refugees cost the government $1 billion a year and have put enormous strain on the resources of a country with just 5.6 million citizens. Senior officials from the two states made the appeal at a meeting convened by the United Nations in Geneva to tackle the humanitarian crisis caused by the displacement of nearly 4 million Iraqis fleeing conflict either inside or outside of Iraq. Jordanian economist Ghassan Muammar.
When they speak economics, they should put all the angles of the equation to make their formula right. Iraqis do cost Jordan a lot of money, but they have also supported the economy and have secured a lot of hard currency to the Jordanian economy.
The refugee situation has caused some Jordanian tensions to flare as prices rise for food and housing. But economist Ghassan Muammar warns against scapegoating and points out that the refugees have also injected millions into the country's fragile economy and have opened businesses and created thousands of job opportunities. In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
A United Nations report has accused Sudan of sending warplanes and other heavy weapons into Darfur in violation of a Security Council resolution. Haider Rizbi reports from the United Nations.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said today that he is deeply concerned and troubled by the evidence that the Sudanese government is using aircraft painted with UN markings. The report was leaked by a diplomat to the New York Times yesterday, soon after UN officials announced that Sudan had agreed to allow a small UN peacekeeping force to enter Darfur. Describing Sudan's decision as a positive step, Ban Ki-moon said yesterday that Khartoum should let the UN force in as soon as possible. Diplomats and observers say the disclosure about the use of military aircraft in Darfur by Sudan could complicate international efforts to address the Darfur crisis by political means. Both the US and Britain are now seeking to impose sanctions against Sudan. However, it's not clear whether Russia and China would support such a move. In the past 4 years, more than 200,000 people have been killed as a result of the ongoing ethnic conflict in Darfur. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
The Senate failed to pass a measure today that would allow the government to negotiate drug prices for Medicare patients. The House passed a similar version in January. Medicare drug reform passed Congress 2 years ago. Republicans and the Bush administration have hailed the program as a success, but many patients find the rules confusing and the procedures difficult to navigate. A number of congressional Democrats want to renegotiate the terms, saying the current program is a huge giveaway to the pharmaceutical industry. The Senate may soon negotiate language for a new measure that could gain enough Republican support to pass. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. Supreme Court issued a major ruling today, upholding a ban on a second trimester abortion procedure. It's the biggest reversal to abortion practice since Roe v. Wade more than 30 years ago. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
In a 5-4 ruling, the Supreme Court banned a common second trimester abortion called dilation and evacuation, also known as D&E, or to abortion opponents, partial birth abortion. The Supreme Court did not make an exception common to abortion law, an exception when the woman's health is in danger. Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion of the majority. He was joined by the two most recent additions to the court, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, both Bush nominees. The case is a result of an abortion ban that passed Congress in 2003 and signed by the president. Abortion activists on both sides of the issue were quick and passionate in their response. With the pillars of the Supreme Court in the background, a coalition of groups webcast live an hour-long event praising the court's ruling. Katie Mahoney with the Christian Defense Coalition was one of those speakers.
We rejoice today for the sanity that has finally dawned upon the court in banning it. And we're very, very grateful for that. And we see this gratefully as an end, the beginning of the end of Roe v. Wade.
And that's one thing the two sides agree on. Eleanor Smeal is president of the Feminist Majority.
They can just keep striking one blow after another to women's health, to women's protection for abortion. And that's, we got to stop it because it's clear what they're trying to do. They're trying to essentially reverse the right to legal abortion.
The only woman on the court, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, wrote the dissent. She said, quote, "Today's decision is alarming." D&E is often hailed as the safest and most common of second trimester abortion procedures. Janet Krebs is with the Center for Reproductive Rights.
All of the doctors who challenge this law and who testified in court against this law are truly committed to providing the best care they can for their patients. They're committed to continue to do that, and will be looking to their attorneys to help them figure out, you know, exactly how they can maximize the care to their patients without worrying about violating the law.
A Supreme Court decision allows 25 days before enactment. Clinics, attorneys, and doctors say they'll have to carefully read through the 35-page decision to decipher their obligation. Doctors who don't follow the law can receive jail time. Eleanor Smeal says this decision will go beyond the ruling and will guide state and local legislatures as well.
They keep on passing one restriction after another. You can't even keep track of it because they're getting a green light now from the Supreme Court.
And the abortion debate will not go away anytime soon. The Democratic-led Congress is expected to introduce a bill that would challenge this ruling and expand women's choice. And on the other side, Mary Beth Sherman and her group will continue to pray.
We're actually just praying to God to end abortion in America. And that's our main mandate of standing out here.
And they'll stand on the steps of the Supreme Court with red tape over their mouths reading the word life until they do so. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The House Judiciary Committee might offer immunity to Monica Goodling, the former advisor and White House liaison to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Goodling refused to testify before the committee, pleading the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. This immunity would protect her from that in exchange for testimony about the firings of 8 U.S. attorneys. Representative Linda Sanchez, Democrat of California.
We are still missing a very large piece of the puzzle, and that is the role of the White House in these firings. Ms. Goodling, the chief liaison between the White House and the Department of Justice, is at the very core of this controversy.
The committee decided to postpone the subpoena until next week to see if the White House provides necessary information on the investigation. Ranking Republican on the committee, Lamar Smith of Texas.
And unless something unforeseen occurs during the course of the next week, I would expect us to be able to move forward on this matter next week.
The Justice Department failed to comply with a subpoena ordered for redacted documents. The committee is working with an uncooperative White House to get missing email messages. Attorney General Gonzalez will testify before the Senate Thursday. While most Americans get their food from the supermarket, there are some who seek out the local farmers market to find locally grown and organic food. The demand for organic agriculture has grown over the last few years, prompting Congress to examine the issue. Today, the House of Representatives held their first ever hearing on organic foods. FSRN's Karen Miller was there and files this report.
Today's hearing focused on the economic impacts of the production, processing, and marketing of organic foods. Dennis Cardoza, Democrat from California, is chair of the House of Representatives Committee on Organic Agriculture. He talks about how far the organic farming industry has come.
It was once the domain of ugly broccoli, dried up apples, and wormy tomatoes. Today, the industry offers to the American consumer high quality produce, innovative salad mixes, full lines of convenience foods, and dairy items.
As Congress is reviewing a proposed farm bill for 2007, they're looking closely at organic food agriculture. Organic refers to the way food is grown and processed. It also includes a system of production, distribution, and sales that lets customers know that the food they buy has maintained its organic quality right from the farm. Karen Wilcox is executive director for the Organic Trade Association. She spoke at the hearing today and says organic food has specific guidelines.
Organic foods also must be produced without the use of antibiotics, synthetic hormones, sewage sludge, irradiation, genetic engineering, and other excluded practices. And cloning animals or using their products is considered inconsistent with organic practice.
Many feel that there's a win-win relationship between those who buy organic foods and those who grow them. Bea James, program manager for the National Cooperative Grocers Association.
Organic consumers have a strong philosophical desire to support local agriculture and value the quality and freshness they receive in doing so. Organic consumers also appreciate the smaller ecological footprint the distribution of local organic food makes. If we are to maintain the hope and promise that organic agriculture has become, it is critical that we meet the consumer demand with ample supply and continued standards based in organic integrity. Simply put, we need more organic farms and continued government funding for expanding the organic sector in agriculture.
He also states that increasing organic agriculture research, lowering crop insurance premiums, and having more competitive markets would help those who grow organic. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
Scientists, activists, and religious leaders from around the globe are gathered in Washington, D.C. this week to call attention to the impacts of global warming. As Yan Meixie reports, participants of the conference warn that people in the poorest countries will suffer the most.
Salimul Haq is director of the Climate Change Group at the International Institute for Environment and Development. For the past 2 years, he has traveled around the world seeking solutions to global warming, but avoided the United States. He says he was disheartened by the U.S. inaction to curb greenhouse gas emissions. Now, Huck says he sees encouraging signs that the U.S. is finally awakening to the reality of a warming planet.
My first message to the rest of you, all of you, is welcome back to the world, because the world has moved on. You have been stuck behind for a very long time, and you have a lot of catching up to do.
One of the predicted consequences of global warming is rising sea levels. Sasmita Dasgupta is a senior economist in the environmental team of the World Bank's Development Research Group. She says poor countries will suffer the most from higher sea levels.
If the sea level is to rise only by 1 meter in this century, 57 million people of the developing world will be adversely affected. In terms of region, if we look at percentage impact of population, the Middle East, North Africa region would be most seriously affected.
South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu addressed the conference via a taped video. The Nobel Peace Prize winner says the U.S. has been shirking its responsibilities as the largest contributor of greenhouse gases.
With only 5% of the world's population, the United States contributes about 25% of the Earth's greenhouse gases. Meanwhile, 14% of the world's population lives on the African continent, but Africans contribute only 3% of the global greenhouse gas emissions that cause climate change.
Madeleine Helmer, director of the Climate Center at the Red Cross, says Americans have to recognize that the rest of the world feel the impact of their activities.
We should not make people strangers of us by blaming them on using energy. It's part of our system, but we should also increase the engagement of people. Yes, you don't do this to harm, but it does have that effect. So get engaged and find solutions, and don't make it reality that other people are suffering from our way of life.
Speakers urged the U.S. government to take drastic and immediate action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in order to minimize the country's contributions to global warming. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
In Indonesia, thousands of workers from Freeport McMoRan's Grasberg mine are striking for better wages, better job training, and improved working conditions. Rebecca Henschke reports from Jakarta on the workers' demands for the company running one of the world's largest gold and copper mines.
Dressed in Freeport uniforms and headbands, workers chanted protest slogans as they gathered near the head office in the town of Timika. Tongyoi Papua, the union behind the action, is demanding better pay and conditions for native Papuan workers. Nentu, one of the striking workers, says they're treated unjustly.
Freeport is the wealthiest mining company in Indonesia, but they pay us smaller wages than other companies. Most native Papuans are frontline workers, the lowest paid and in the lowest position. It's totally unfair because this is our land and our natural wealth.
The workers are demanding a significant wage increase of $200 a month or a 250% increase. The U.S.-owned mine is one of the world's largest and wealthiest gold and copper mines, and the area around Freeport is one of the most expensive places to live in Indonesia. The workers' union claims the current wages for native Papuans are not enough to survive on. Freeport management says they have received the workers' list of demands, but they say wage increases will be dealt with through the usual internal channels and will not be achieved through strikes. Mindo Pangaribuan is the company's spokesperson.
There is no discrimination against native Papuan workers. They are given the same opportunities as everyone else. Our wages are fair and decided based on the competency and responsibility of the workers and are in line with the market.
The Freeport mine has long been mired in controversy over its environmental impact and the share of revenue going to Papuans. Freeport's operations also came under considerable scrutiny after reports that the company paid substantial sums of money to military and police officials to help secure its mine. Local parliamentarian Markus Saman says Papuans are excluded and repressed in their own land.
Out of the 2,000 native Papuans who work at the site, how many are in management position? None. Papuans are not allowed to become boss in their own land.
The province has a distinct identity and political history. Dutch colonial forces granted Papuan independence in 1961, but after the Dutch pulled out a year later, Jakarta annexed the province. In 2001, the government granted Papua increased autonomy, but has had little tangible benefit on the ground. A major complaint is that much of the revenue from the region's extensive mineral and oil resources is going to the central government's coffers rather than benefiting local people. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rebecca Hinschke of Radio 68H in Jakarta.
Australia has struck a deal with the United States to exchange up to 200 refugees each year. While the government believes the policy will deter asylum seekers, critics have slammed the plan, calling it expensive and inhumane. From Sydney, Erica Voles has more.
Millions around the world dream of gaining a green card to work and live in the United States. But this new policy could see asylum seekers trying to reach Australia sent to the US instead. Conversely, Haitians or Cubans seeking refuge in the US could be sent to the Great Southern Land. For the past decade, Australia, under the Conservative coalition government, has maintained a tough stance against boat people. And since 2001, refugees who reach Australia's outlying islands have been sent to detention centres on nearby Pacific islands such as Nauru, supposedly to deter unauthorised arrivals. The Australian Prime Minister, John Howard, told Australia's national broadcaster, the ABC, that the sole reason for this new plan to exchange asylum seekers with the US was to further deter people smugglers from trying to bring boat people to Australia.
Well, the thing that discourages people from people smuggling is the fact that we make it very plain that people will not be allowed to reach the Australian mainland, that they will be processed offshore, and that we're not going to have our very generous humanitarian refugee program distorted by people smugglers.
Critics have labelled the move both bizarre and costly. Refugee advocate and Democrats deputy leader Andrew Bartlett says the move is an election year stunt. He also questions whether the prospect of being able to eventually seek asylum in the United States will really act as that much of a deterrent to refugees.
Refugees are just trying to find somewhere safe and secure, and if they're just going to end up somewhere like the United States, I'm sure they'd be happy with that. From my point of view, I don't really mind if people are settled in the United States versus being settled in Australia. What I do mind is a process for doing that, which is totally non-transparent and not independent and also ridiculously expensive. Why not just do it according to normal, proper due process?
While it might be argued that refugees are in no position to pick and choose where they gain asylum as long as they are safe, the Refugee Council's John Gibson believes the move violates the spirit of the UN Convention on Refugees.
It sets, in our view, probably a bad precedent, because other countries that without such or better developed systems, without those systems, may well engage in the same sort of arrangements. And the view that we take, and the view I think is generally accepted, is that if people make claims for asylum in a particular country, they should be processed there. And for the last 5 years, Australia has been sending people to countries like Nauru, and also Papua New Guinea. People have languished there for a long period of time, and there have been some real question marks about the quality of how they've been processed.
It's expected that 83 Sri Lankans currently being detained on Nauru will make up the first batch to be sent to the US in the next 6 months. John Gibson remains concerned that they are not being given legal representation, something he says, on top of the current move, represents a new low for Australia's treatment of asylum applicants.
We should have in place a process whereby people who do arrive, even in an unauthorised fashion, are processed and then are accepted in our country as people in need of protection. To send in a quid pro quo relationship, to send people more than halfway across the world in order to get both governments out of what is essentially a difficult situation is really not in conformity with the principles of the convention.
This is Erica Voles in Sydney reporting for FSRN.
Leaders from all 12 South American countries have concluded 2 days of talks on energy issues at a meeting convened by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Daletta Varlisi reports from the island of Margarita, Venezuela.
The main theme of this first meeting on energy natural resources is the joint exploitation of South America's natural gas and oil resources. Continental leaders propose to form a South American Union to be known as UNASUR to achieve independence in terms of politics, economic and energy. Brazilian President Lula da Silva underlines the central importance of energy issues.
We discussed energy issues for the first time. The potential of hydroelectric energy is equivalent to that of all oil resources in the world. We discussed the total potential of gas, of oil, of wind energy, biodiesel energy, of water energy. The potential to give to the people of our continent a place to return to by generating wealth and employment.
The core of yesterday's debate was between President Chavez and President Lula. The two were discussing if it was to give priority to oil exploitation common projects or ethanol production as impulse to the project that Brazil signed with US about a month ago.
Lula, I suggest you sell us ethanol at the best price. We don't need it 10 years from now. We need it now to blend with our gasoline. I also would ask that you tell the U.S. government to drop tariffs on sugarcane ethanol.
The South American leaders also discussed the construction of a gas pipeline linking all of South America from Venezuela down to Brazil, reaching Argentina and Patagonia and extending on a side to Bolivia and Chile. The idea was initially proposed by Venezuela's government in conjunction with the creation of a Southern Development Bank. The Southern Bank, or Banco del Sur, is proposed as an alternative to the World Bank and a possible source for the billions of dollars needed to build this pipeline over the next 20 years. The South American Union will also finance the construction of refineries all over the continent. President of Ecuador, Rafael Correa, explains the importance having refining capacity.
Ecuador is a key location. It is the closest point geographically to Asia, where economies are growing fastest. We will build a big refinery and from there export to countries as China, which faces a big problem in lack of energy to sustain its growth.
President Hugo Chavez explains that all of these proposals are to be collected in a South American Treaty on Energy.
The South American Treaty is proposed by the Energy Working Group of UNASUR. In order to sustain this commitment in the long term, there are four main guidelines of strategic action. First, oil, second, gas, third, renewable energies, and finally, energy conservation.
The first project to be completed is a gas pipeline linking Venezuela and Colombia from Puerto Ordaz on Orinoco River on a diagonal line to Colombian city of Riohacha. New bilateral agreement on singular aspects of energetical partnership are expected in the near future. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Diletta Varlese in Isla Margarita, Venezuela.
You've been listening to FSRN, an independent, listener-supported newscast produced by Tina Gousset and Monica Lopez. Our Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. You can listen to this newscast in its entirety at www.fsrn.org. We welcome your comments, questions, and story ideas. Just email us at comments@fsrn.org. In Richmond, Virginia, I'm Catherine Kump, sitting in for Auto Bogado.